Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planning leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
All right. So what we're going to do today is basically we're going to first kind of give you, when we talk about disciple making systems, I'm going to give you kind of a ground level, and then Ed's going to come and give you the 30,000 foot level. And so first, you know, just to give you a little background, my name is Dahadi Lewis. I'm the lead pastor of Blueprint Church. We planted a church in January 3rd of 2010, and just kind of the little bit of the backdrop of the story. It was a group of us who made a commitment from Atlanta, Georgia. It was 25 of us moved from Denton, Texas to Texas, and that number eventually came 40 people from that moved into the city to plant Blueprint Church. And the reason why, we wanted to go into the urban context, and we wanted to, and the way we define urban is by density and diversity, and we wanted to establish a blueprint. The definition of a blueprint is a plan or a process that's used to start something new. And so when we saw kind of the world becoming more urban, we felt like a lot of churches were becoming more rural and suburban. Like we were leaving the trends of what society is going. And so we wanted to move and to embrace the beauty, the complexity, the density and diversity of the city. And so, and you know, and at the end, you know, our goal ultimately was about making disciples, right? And so just to kind of give you an understanding of kind of where I'm coming from, my call to pastorate wasn't a call primarily to preach. My call to the pastor was a call to make disciples, and I felt that the church was the best platform to do that, right? And I think a lot of times what we miss, sometimes as pastors and leaders and people in the church, we kind of have disciple making in one category, and we have like stuff we do in the church in another. And a lot of times we don't see the connection. So even a lot of times when I see people who are on staff at church or pastors at church, it's sort of like, well, I do the stuff that I do with the church, but then I also have a group of people that I make disciples with. And a lot of times they're not one and the same. And so really one of the goals that we have always had is this, like, if the commission for every one of us is to make disciples, the Great Commission, and if the church is the primary vehicle that God wants that he's using, then there must be a problem with either the way we're viewing disciple making or the way we're seeing the church. And so my heart has always been is, how do we make disciple making not a ministry of the church, but how do we make disciple making the ministry of the church? You know, and so, and this is really the heartbeat behind what we're doing. It really came from Matthew chapter 9, 35 through 38, when Jesus is grieved, you know, and he's going from to and fro and healing every sickness and every disease, but he's grieved about, and what's interesting about that is that I don't know about you, but if every sickness and every disease mean that Jesus was healing 100% of the people, right, every sickness, every disease, but he didn't have the type of response that you and I would have. Because I don't know if you and I, if we were going, would anybody be excited, praising the Lord, if we had 50% ratio of people getting healed, right? Like 50%, I would be like doing backflips, right? How about 25%, 20%, 10? If one out of every 10 person that I came with was healed, and like that would be an amazing. But for some reason, Jesus, instead of being thrilled, A.T. Robin said he was literally sick to his stomach. He was crouched over, right? And what made him so grieved is the fact that he says, they're like sheep without shepherds, right? And then for the first time, he turns to his disciples who have been watching him, and he says, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Pray to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. And so, really, from the very beginning, Jesus basically makes the thing is that the problem with what we're talking about, multiplying, the problem that we're trying to overcome is not a problem of the harvest. It's not the problem that there's people in our neighborhoods that don't want to hear the gospel. The problem is that there's a lack of laborers for the harvest. And I think, and my fear is that too many of us have reduced Christianity to conferences, concerts, and church services. And we have lost the idea of what it means to make disciples where life exists. And so our goal as a church is that we said that our desire, that we wanted to be an answer to the prayer of Matthew chapter 9, 37 and 38. Because he says, pray for more laborers for the harvest. And so this is the heartbeat behind kind of what we're doing and why we're doing what we're doing. And so we were able to start and plant a church in January 30, 2010. And from there, we have been going. We've been able to plant multiple churches. From that, we have had specifically 5 churches that have come from directly from our church in those first 6 years. And kind of our philosophy of ministry is that, you know, we want to saturate both Atlanta and the United States with gospel-centered disciple-making churches that make disciple-making the ministry of the church. And so what I want to do is just kind of give you a little breakdown of what that looks like in our context. And again, so I'm going to start off more on a practitioner level, and then Ed is going to come and give more of the big picture. So I'm going to refrain from a lot of kind of the big picture and stay with the practitioner. So again, the overall statement is disciple-making is a ministry of the church. The disciple-making is not a ministry of the church. It is the ministry of the church. And so the goal has been is how do we make every single ministry in our church about disciple-making? How do we create that dynamic? And so literally, we take this a very literal statement. We have 288 covenant members in our church. And in that, we basically say that a call to membership is a call to discipleship. And so for every covenant member that says that they want to be a member of the church, we take it in the same way as if someone came to me and says, Dahati, will you disciple me? And so we have that type of intentionality in what we're doing. And we says, will you disciple me? And this is the very essence of what we do. And so we have 288 covenant members. And so out of every one of our covenant members, we tell them in the very beginning, we say that every member of our church is either a bivocational church planter or a bivocational church planting team member, right? And so we're building in the very DNA at the very outset. And ultimately, all we're doing is what Jesus said when he called his first disciples. He says, follow me and I will make you fishers of men, right? So at the very core, he says, this is the goal, is that I want you to become a fisher of men. And so we set this out, we set this up on the outset. And so what I want to do is I want to give you like 6 things that I think you have to consider if you're going to develop things that we consider in developing a disciple-making system in our church. That's how we make disciple-making not a ministry, but the ministry. So here's some of the disciple-making strategy. First is that you have to have a functional DNA, right? A functional DNA. And really when we talk about the core, what is the core of what you're trying to do? What are the aims? I mean, it makes sense like when we're in seminary or when you're in class. And whenever you go to a class, the professor on the first day as he walks through the syllabus, he says, the aims of this course is that at the end of this time, you will be able to do this, 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 and this, right? And so it's the same way for us. We say that when you come, if you spend a significant amount of time with us, we should be able to parachute you on any remote island, and all you have is a Bible. You're the only believer in the midst of all non-believers, and all you have is a Bible, that you should be able to spark a movement. And so what we do is we take that picture and we reverse engineer is what does a person need to have in order to spark a movement? And if all he has a Bible, he's the only believer in the midst of all non-believers. And so in that, you got to think about it. It's the Bible also without commentary, right? There's no podcast, there's no, you know, Google, there's none of that. So you just have to really look at your word and be able to spark a movement. And we reverse it, what does a person need in order to do that? And so all of our ministry is around this DNA, and I'll talk about it in a minute, but is this DNA. And what we do is we try to aim to accomplish that end. So we first start with, you have to begin this, what is your aim? You see, because many times as believers, what we do is like we get the bow and arrow, we'll take the bow and arrow, we'll shoot the bow and arrow, we'll walk over wherever the bow and arrow hit, and we're like, man, God was all in that. Right? And it's kind of like wherever it hit, that's what God wanted. Instead of having a clear aim of what we're trying to do, because when you have an aim, you begin to know what you do, what you are trying to do, and what you're not. You can separate good from great. Right? Because one of the things, there's a lot of things you can do, but what are the things that you must do? And you have to begin to distill. You see, and the reason why we come with, and we took that picture of a person on a remote island and all he has is a Bible, is because you might think it's far-fetched, but for many of us, that's what many of our people are on their job every single day. And a lot of them don't even have the Bible. Right? And so we're raising up missionaries, right? Missionaries for the harvest. So we have to understand a functional DNA, and I'll come back to that. But the second is that you have to have a clear assimilation process. You have to have a clear assimilation process. And so what we do, that anytime any person who's ever come to our church, we put them into three categories, if you've ever filled out anything. One is that you are either a guest, you're a friend, or you're family. We track every single one. Our goal is that we want our guests to become friends and friends to become family, right? And so guests, we track for 5 weeks. And we, from the time we get their information, and what we say is that we are trying, and let me back up a little bit. Right now, we average about 15 guests every single week that comes to our church that fills out a card, 15 guests. So out of these 15 guests, we just started praying and like, if you just multiply that by 52, because that's the average and that's a low end, that's 725 people every single year that is coming to the church. And they're saying, I want to be known, because otherwise they wouldn't fill out a card. They would just come in and leave. So these are people who say they want to be known. And so we feel that we have a stewardship to, when we say, to mobilize the 288 to reach the 725. And so, again, even in our assimilation process, we build in disciple-making about mobilizing our people to do that. And again, so we have guests, we track for 4 to 5 weeks. Our friends are non-covenant members that are participating with us further in the gospel. Right. So they're on somebody's ministry team, someone's, either they're giving regularly, but they're just not covenant members. So we also track friends. And this is, and I'll share with you later, how we also on average, we're always so averaging about 20 new people coming. And we do membership classes every 2 months, and it's about 20 every single time, because we're constantly looking at the friends list and we're calling them to discipleship, to greater disciple making. And we're distinguishing the both. And so you have to begin to think through your assimilation process. How are you taking a person from guest to friend to family? Right? And so we're constantly thinking through that. The third one is life-on-life disciple-making. Life-on-life. And so, you know, when we talk about disciple-making, the problem is that we all would say life-on-life disciple-making, but the problem is that we have reduced life-on-life disciple-making to a once-a-week meeting at Starbucks when I'm going to ask you about your life, right? Right? And that's not ultimately what disciple, when we talk about life-on-life, that's not what I see Jesus doing. Is this once-a-week, one-hour-a-week meeting, and then we say, yeah, this is my disciple-making strategy. Because a lot of times as I talk to pastors, and I say, well, what is your disciple-making strategy? We're a disciple-making church. Well, what is that strategy? Well, what I do is I get with a group of guys. I got about 8 to 12 guys, and I meet with them once a week at Starbucks. And we get the best-selling book of the time, and we just kind of walk through. They read a chapter, and we discuss it. And, you know, it was just like, well, that's the whole plan of disciple-making. And for many of us, that's our plan. So the question is how are you building in a DNA of disciple-making in the church? And again, the idea with not just one member or 12 members, but two for us, 288 members. And so how do we do that? And, you know, and so we'll, that number four is theological training. And when I mean about theological training, basically I really mean how do they understand God better, more? That we talk about Christianity is not a religion, but it's relationships. right? It's about relationships. And when you'll hear, we talk about our relationship with God, our relationship with other believers, and our relationship with our neighbors, right? And so the question that we always talk about is, how are we informing our theology to help grow those relationships? Paul says it very simply. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and 4, he says, the aim of my instruction is love. From a pure heart, a sincere faith, and a clear conscience. Just imagine if we would mobilize, and if every single time we taught, that our goal was that would people would fall more in love with God, more in love with other believers, and more in love with their neighbors. If that was the actual goal, think about how different our Christianity would be. And so we talk about theological training, not just in making people better at Bible trivia, but how do they better understand the person and work of Jesus so they can fall more in love with him and fall more in love with his people, right, and his mission, right? And so we talk about theological training. The next one is leadership development. What is your strategy? You know, for us, we talk about what's our goal from taking the person off the street, drug dealing, to becoming an elder. Do you have a clear process to doing that, right? Like, as leaders of churches and as ministry leaders, we are always to be looking for disciples and training them up. And the question is how clear is that process to doing that? So we want to be very clear in the process of disciple making and taking them through the leadership development. And number six is church mobilization. Church mobilization is basically, we believe that disciple making, God puts us on mission. God uses missions as a tool for our sanctification, right? A lot of times we'll just say, you know, missions is the overflow of your quiet time, which is true. But what I also would say is that mission, in a lot of ways, is your quiet time, because you will experience God in a different way on mission that you're not going to experience him alone in your room. There's a different level of depending. And what we have to do is be able to teach. And so what we do as at the church is that even our mission trips, every time we go on mission as a church, that we organize, that it is primarily for our people, secondarily for the people that we're going to reach. Why do I say that? Think about the feeding of the 5,000. In the feeding of the 5,000, you had Jesus working with, you know, they had 5,000 people plus. And in this, the disciples came and was like, Jesus, we need to get rid of them. You know, this is getting dark. It's, you know, all this. And he says, we need to give them. We don't have food. He's like, you feed them. He was like, well, wait a minute. We don't have enough food. All we got is a few fishes and a few loaves. Right? And he says, go out there and divide them up. First, you see that there's an act of faith because he tells them to go and divide them up. And he already's like, why am I dividing them up? I don't got enough resources to do this. He goes out and they go out in the act of faith, dividing them up. What I would say in that is that most of the people, the 5,000, probably didn't even know a miracle was taking place. They probably thought, man, they have a lot of food back there. Right? But it was the disciples that knew that God is taking the very little that I have and making much of himself. You see, this makes all the sense in the world. When we go on mission trips, who's impacted the most? We are. The people that are going than the people that we actually go and minister to. Do you understand? No matter how much you eat, right? If you eat three, you're like full. You're full and you, like 3 to 4 hours later, guess what's going to happen? You're going to be hungry again. And guess what happened to those 5,000 people? They got hungry again. About 4 or 5, their life wasn't primarily changed forever, but it was disciples that looked at Jesus and said, what manner of man is this? And so in all of our mission trips, we are primarily focusing on training our people because we want to, and we'll talk about unleash them to do ministry where life exists. And so we use everything that we do as a church as a disciple-making tool to training our people. All right? So spend a couple of minutes and talk about, okay, unpacking what this looks like more so specifically at our church. But before I get to any questions about these, all right, so what I want to do real quick is just give you, if you are a member, if this is a membership class, just to kind of give you an understanding. The first thing we talk about, the DNA of our church. And when we talk about the DNA of our church, what are we trying to do? We want them to know clearly what our aim is, just like Jesus did in the very first calling. And so we say, here's the DNA of Blueprint Church. And we just did a series, and we do this consistently, right? In our series, and our goal is that we want every one of our covenant members to memorize the DNA, right? And the reason why is because I don't know if you guys are familiar with Bloom's taxonomy, but at the bottom of Bloom's taxonomy is this idea of remembering and memorizing, and at the end is recreating or being able to create. So that, and it's like steps to getting them there. So the first step is that they got to understand where we're going. So that hypothetically, if we were to put them into 288 different rooms, that all of our covenant members should be able to give us the DNA. Because we know Andy Stanley says vision leaks. And so we want them to be clear. So why we're doing what we're doing, right? And so we'll go through series and we'll regularly do to making sure that everybody knows clearly where we're going. So that's why we're talking about what is our DNA. And so our DNA is this. One is that our philosophy, we believe that the gospel changes people and people change the world. That we don't have anything new. It's the gospel that changes us and we change the world. So therefore, as a church, we exist to unleash healthy people to do ministry where life exists. So think about it. If the gospel changes people and people change the world, then if we're God's conduit to the world, then it's our responsibility to equip and unleash those people, healthy people, to do ministry where they live, where they work, where they play. Right? And so from that, then you have to, the logical question is, well, what is a healthy person? We believe that a healthy person, again, we said Christianity is not, it's about healthy relationships, that is someone who is growing in the gospel in the context of family while on mission. Right? And so it's a three-legged stool, gospel, family, mission. Growing our relationship with God, growing our relationship with other believers in the church, and growing our relationship with our neighbors. Right? And so we want to help cultivate those three relationships so that we can all fall in love with our Savior, with our Maker. Right? And so we're doing that. And so when we talk about our philosophy, we say, what are our aims? And our aims are very specific. We say we want to be gospel-centered. Right? That we believe that the gospel, so this is our DNA. We define health by people growing in the gospel in the context of family while on mission. The next one, right? Here's our aims. So again, everything we're doing, we're trying to aim at this. And in here, we specifically said these are identities, not activities, right? Because if you just simply do it, people can do activities, but we are trying to aim at who you are, not necessarily what you do. Because who you are, Paul was a missionary, and if he was in prison, guess what? People in prison were coming to know the Lord. If he was shipwrecked, the people who were shipwrecked with him was coming to know the Lord. If wherever he was a missionary. It wasn't like, well, I have this ministry, and that's not my ministry, so I don't do that over here. No, he understood his identity. So we talk about our identity is that we, one, we say the gospel center, that the gospel reshapes our identity in which we think, we speak, and we live as people who have been made new. That we are a new creation in Christ, right? That we're also responsible siblings, that the church is not like family, but the church is family in which we are responsible for one another. So we aim at responsibility. Every single year, we're asked, we talk to every single covenant member. All right? In every covenant member, let me say this, that in those 288, as a church and as leadership, we talk about every single covenant member every single month. We pray about for every single covenant member every single month. Why? Because the church is not like family, it is family. And so we need to know where family is. And I just started making a dangerous application. What would I do if this was my nuclear family? Right? You see, we say it's like family. And we're like, you know, it's like family. It's like they're like our church is like play cousins. Right? They're not like really family. Right? But then I said, what do I do when I said I'm married, we have six kids, me and my wife, and I sit down at night with my wife and I simply say, and I will talk. How is Nathaniel doing? And she'll tell me how Nathaniel's doing. How's Brayden doing? She'll tell me how Brayden's doing. How's DJ? How's Briah? House J, House Trinity. And we'll just walk through each one. And for each one, we become and we create a plan for them. Well, if they're struggling with math, well, what do we need to do to help them? Well, if they're struggling with this, what do we need to? So it's the same way with the church. We talk about every single covenant member. Where are they? How do we help create a plan? And so what we do in terms of fleshing out structurally this responsibility, when you become a covenant member, you are now assigned. Every covenant member is assigned to a missional community. And in that missional community, they are assigned. And so even when we accept them as members, they have to be accepted by their missional community and as the whole church and affirmed by the elders. And we say Sam Dula is a part of, you know, has been accepted by the missional community and the elders and affirmed. And he is now put in the primary care of the old Fourth Ward missional community. And so now the way we track them every single month, there's an MC checkup list that we have. And then we are checking up on every single covenant member, and we're asking, and we're going through, how is Sam? How is Tim? How is Shane? How is so-and-so? And we'll walk through every covenant member, and we divide it up, and we're doing that through our MC leaders. And so we're walking through every covenant member every single week, and we're saying, and you know, and if there's four, then some we'll put on the cares list, and those people on the cares list, about 5 minutes, put them on the cares list. And the cares list is people who, you're on the cares list for four reasons, and I'll wrap this up, is that for inactivity in the missional community, if you're not involved in the life of the people that you're connected with, if you're not, if you have an extreme crisis, an extreme celebration, or you're transitioning. We don't just let, you know, when we have kids, we don't just send them off. We make sure that they're in another church and they're in a healthy place. And so there's this commitment. So that's what we're talking about. We're responsible. When I went home, I ruptured my patella tendon 2 years ago. And when I went home, I didn't have to give my family a pep talk about things. They knew that their life was about to change. Why? Because they're responsible for me. And so we drive at responsibility, not activity. So there was a couple that was having, you know, a couple of couples were having troubles in the missional community. And they was just like, well, you know, we need to start a, you know, marriage ministry. Like, no, we're not starting a marriage ministry. And that's what we do, is that we end up starting a ministry for everything, and then we have a lot of overhead and a very little ministry actually taking place. And we says, no, you're responsible. You figure it out. When my oldest son has a problem, we don't start our older son's ministry. Right? No. The family gets together, and they work through how to do it. And so what happened was they went, and the singles got together and says, what we're going to do is we're going to babysit your kids this week. We're going to send the couples off, and you guys are going to get some time together. It was responsible. They let them work it out. But we're always trying to create systems to lessen it. So we're talking about how to build a culture of disciple making where we're mobilizing a multitude of disciples, where 288 people are being discipled. So responsible sibling. The next one is indigenous disciple maker, where we are trying to allow you to make disciples where you live, where you work, and where you play. That every single person is a bivocational church planter or a bivocational church planting team member. And so we're trying to bring, our roof just fell, our ceiling just fell in for 8 weeks. We are so committed to discipleship. Instead of going in and buying another facility, what we did was we said, hey, we're going to meet in 8 different locations. And in these 8 different locations, in their different homes, and we prayed that one day in the next 10 years that we will have a tangible presence of the gospel, a local church in every one of these locations. And we went in and we did, so even God's providence, this is because we want to drive home our DNA. About disciple making, where you live, where you work, where you play, right? And then finally, generous stewards. After we cultivate those three relationships of relationship with God, relationship with other believers, and relationship with our neighbors, then what we're saying is that a generous steward is you manage all of your time, all of your treasures as resources for God's purposes. So cultivate a relationship with God, with other believers, and with our neighbors. And then we lose all of our steward, all of our time, talent, and treasure to cultivate those three relationships. And so every single covenant member at our church understands what it is, what we're trying to do. And what it does is it's given us the ability that we'll send a group in, a missionary in, they'll go into the neighborhood, they love the neighborhood, they start a missional community. That missional community begins to launch other missional communities because people are on mission. And then we start a church. Last year, we sent out 100 people. And then we're only a church of 288 covenant members, another 100 to 150 friends and guests. We started 100 people. We send them over to Cornerstone in the West in another part. Next year, Clarkston, we're going to be sending another group of 75 to 100 over there. And so we're one service. We get to a place, we send them out. We get to a place, we send them out. And because we're raising up missionaries, the goal of what we're trying to do is to answer, be an answer to the prayer, Matthew chapter 9, 37, 38. The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Now just imagine the day that if we have 288 covenant members who are serious about fulfilling the Great Commission and making disciples. It's not in the big events. It's in unleashing the everyday people and making them missionaries.
Though I'd much rather hear from Dahati if I were in your situation, but we're talking about systems today. And so how do systems help facilitate church planting? Research project we did a few years ago, I was asked by, hired by an organization called Leadership Network with a donor-driven project to ask the question, what's happening in church planting in North America today? Part of the assignment was I hired 9 people. We worked together for about 11 months. And the largest study ever done of its kind. It actually never will be published, which is odd, but we published all the positive findings in a book called Viral Churches. But I actually analyzed the negative trends. Things were going badly. I ranked denominations by their efficacy, things of that sort. My denomination, by the way, at the time, Southern Baptist, which is kind of here, was actually near the bottom. And one of the reasons I didn't release it was I actually worked for that denomination. And so desiring long-term employment, I chose not to. Now that I don't work there anymore, I can tell you. However, I will tell you, just kind of an aside, I spoke to the trustees of the North American Mission Board, which is the organization that you've mentioned sponsors this track, and I think now they have turned it around to such a degree that North American Mission Board is actually leading, the leading church planting denomination right now in North America today. So it's a remarkable turnaround, quite stunning, to be perfectly honest. But in there, in that study, a couple of things we did. For example, I read every book written on church planting in the English language published since 1954. Book, dissertation, study project, anything out there that's actually been done on the subject. And what you found was a significant shift took place in the late 80s. And so everything before the late 80s, everything's probably too strong of a word, but the vast majority of resources before the late 80s talked about church planting in terms of churches sending out people to start new churches, which is a good thing, which is a fascinating thing, but it lacked one thing, a focus on church planters, which was kind of fascinating. So actually, the best-selling book on church planting was by a guy named Jack Redford, and he's with the Lord now, but when I wrote my first book, he wrote Planting New Churches. I wrote Planting Missional Churches, but I framed it because I used the outline from his book. But he had what was called 9 steps to planting a church, and in Redford's 9 steps, which he lays out, he says, the 9 steps are blank, 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 blank. He goes through all 9 of them. And then the end result is that you get a church, you start a church missions committee. So remember, this is 70s thinking. Church mission committee, pick an area, cultivate the area, send the people. There's no mention of a pastor in all 9 of the steps. But something happens in the late 80s and the early 90s, largely around conversations facilitated by Fuller Seminary, the Fuller Institute. And what happened was people began to say, are there some systems that would produce and facilitate a greater impact in church planting? And so Bob Logan began to do a project. Charles Ridley was hired and contracted to look into more information. So assessment became a system. Actually, the first book published on the idea of systems was actually by Kevin Manoia, who's a Free Methodist bishop, now related to Azusa Pacific University. Well, actually not anymore, but connected there. I think he's no longer the dean. But the idea, and by the way, that was called, 1994, Church Planting the Next Generation, which unfortunately came out right around the time Star Trek The Next Generation came out, so all of us thought he was Commander Riker. But what happened was there was a shift to systems thinking in church planting that really accelerated substantially by focusing on the church planter. Now, I wrote my PhD dissertation on this shift to systems. So don't worry, I'm not going to recount my PhD dissertation to you, though I know that that's really what you'd like to do. And so one day, a group of people are going to get together and say, could you just tell us about your PhD? Right now, 4 people have actually read the 380 pages I labored over in my PhD dissertation. But those systems all of a sudden became tools, catalytic tools, that accelerated church planting. And so now systems thinking is kind of the mainstream, but often lacking. Now systems as a whole include systems like assessment. Okay, so we got assessment. We've got coaching. We've got probably networks. So as you think about church planting, you invariably will draw to some sort of systemic approach to facilitate church planting. Now, in wave one of the systems, which I love, right? So in systems wave one, the focus became on supporting vocational church planters for ministry, right? So it became on supporting vocational church planters for ministry. So think in terms of, again, I'm trying to lay out to you three waves. So in wave one, the idea was we needed to support these planters. So wave one of systems is and this would be, I had the privilege of kind of being on the kind of the tail end of wave one. I wasn't there at the beginning. This started in the late 80s. I was planting a church in 1988 in the inner city of Buffalo, New York, among the urban poor, and we didn't have systems in that level. But at that time, agencies, actually it was Tom Niebel was training and others were sort of laying for, Bob Logan, were laying forth these ideas, and in wave one, systems was supporting the vocational planter. Now again, this was a huge step forward. Don't miss this. It's a huge step forward. As one who is an unsupported vocational church planter, this was a game changer for church planting. And so what happened was church planting began in the 90s to move from the sidelines as something that sort of accidentally happened when a church was interested about it to something that was organizationally and systemically occurring because people were strategizing for more effective church planting. And wave one continues today, right? So wave one didn't come crash and end, but wave one was built upon by wave two. Okay, so wave two is actually the expansion away from the vocationally trained clergy with the application of systems in and on others. So for example, about half of churches in the U.S. are planted bivocationally, we think. People always ask me to quantify that, I get called by reporters all the time. So how many people are bivocational? And it's a fascinating question. There's a couple of books out on the subject, but nobody knows because the vast majority of bivocational planters don't show up on anybody's radar screen, right? Because they're just doing it and getting it done. I think of my friend Dan Wheeler. So Dan Wheeler, dear friend of mine, graduated from Philadelphia College of the Bible. He was pastoring a church. I was planting both in the inner city of Buffalo, New York. I took him down to a conference. I said, man, you gotta lighten up a little bit. You gotta walk in the spirit a little bit more. So I took him to a conference, Assemblies of God had a conference, just had a little bit of fun. And again, I'm not a Pentecostal, though. I love Pentecostals. Pentecostals in the room, raise both hands. All right, good. Love you. Okay. So I love Pentecostals. And you're just so squeaky tight. So I took him to this thing. And so he goes to this thing. He gets baptized in the Holy Spirit, slain in the Spirit, initial physical evidence, speaking in tongues. And so all of a sudden, he gets fired by his church, the whole nine yards. And I'm like, man, I just wanted you to lighten up and sing better music. And so what he does, he goes, gets the job. Nobody knows him. And so he goes out and plants the Word of Faith Tabernacle out of this. So this Philadelphia College of the Bible, subsequently baptized in the Holy Spirit, now out planting this church. He's on nobody's radar screen. So and he's a storefront in the inner city of Buffalo, New York. So the vast majority of bivocational plants, nobody knows, nobody's tracking. Why? Because wave one we could track because it was vocational. Somebody graduated from a Concordia at an LCMS school. We know where he came from. We know where he's going. Southern Baptists track them, right? Assemblies of God have chips in their necks and follow them around. So we know where they are. Wave two expands this ultimately to others. But the systems themselves are still very, very similar to the wave one systems, right? With some modification. Assessment of house church planters would and is and should be different. So we have assessment, we have coaching, we have networks. All these things become an expansion. So church planting, instead of becoming a professional sport, becomes more of an amateur sport, okay? And that's a good thing. That's a good thing, right? So wave one vocational, wave two is the expansion away from solely vocational, but still has vocational. Now, wave three is kind of where we are right now. It's not an expansion of use, which was this, use, but it's an expansion of the systems themselves. So now people are asking the question, all right, so how might we move forward in a direction where we see a significant increase in church planting capacity? It will require systems, for example, that are scalable in a way that the current systems are not. It will require delivery systems, for example, where we flip the classroom, where people are doing online training so that they can, the capacity is unlimited, and they're in community in their churches. And so wave three has a few characteristics, okay? So wave one and wave two tended to be driven by organizations and denominations. That's terrible handwriting. A denom, which looks like demon, but it is not. It's denom, not demon. That's an important distinction from between two. But a couple of things begin to change here, right? So systems tend to be organizational driven. Now, in wave three, they tend to be local church. Okay, you saw Dahati talk some about how every person's a bivocational church planner, how they're putting this in the DNA of their church. Those words are not things that anybody said, in or out of the mainstream. Again, I use anybody, probably too totalizing of a word. But I never heard anybody say that when I was planning my first church in 1988. And I never heard anyone say anything like it until probably 2005, 2006. Now, are there dangers of that? Yes. Okay, so let's say we get to the place where everybody's sort of doing it like what the Dahati's doing, but without the systems thinking that the Dahati intuitively brings into that context. What you end up with is you end up back at the top where people are engaging in these church planning endeavors, but they haven't been walked well through a system. So, and this is always the case, right? So, I mean, and this is it's almost, it's not quite the diffusion of innovation, but, you know, wave one is, man, we're super focused on this. Wave two, a lot of people can do this. Let's get more people involved. Wave three is everyone can do this, and then you get to wave four, and nobody's doing it well. Right? I mean, you've seen that, how that kind of works, right? Right? So, and that's not an uncommon thing. But I think that the whole do-it-yourself movement, that Home Depot, you know, their theme is, we can do it, you can help. I think wave three is where we flip some of the roles and where local churches can do it and we can help those who serve in denominations or organizations and networks. And so I think that's the important distinction between the two. Okay, so wave three includes a local church focus. Letter B, it includes, in a way that wasn't there before, different tracks within the system. Okay, so in the vocational track, okay, so when the Assemblies of God sends out a church planner through the Church Multiplication Network, that church planner goes through an assessment process. He or she will have passed or not passed, will then go through, and there's districts involved, things of that sort, and then there'll be a grant of funds that's given to that person, okay? And so that grant of funds will be given to that church planner, and he or she will then go out and plant a church in Boise, wherever, okay? Because Pentecostals are big in Boise. So here's the thing. Now, that's definitely wave one thinking, right? So they went to Evangel for their undergrad. They went to AGTS for their MDiv. They're well-equipped, right? Wave one thinking. Now, the tricky thing is that as we have diffused the systems, we have to remember the necessity of treating vocational paid church planters in ways that we have learned now for three decades work. So I would say to my people, anyone can plant a church, but if I'm funding you and I'm sending you out on a full-time basis, I expect your process to look like the process we've used for 30 years with good success. Now, the challenge is now with tracks, so let's say with the rise, you know, Assemblies of God churches are going to be kind of walk, a lot of them walk in a stream where ARC would be influential, association-related churches, so they want to plant, you know, a Seacoast or a James River, and so I'm just, some of you, Assemblies of God know what I'm talking about. Now, then somebody comes along and they went to a different conference, right? So now they want to be a missional, incarnational community of Christ followers on a mission of societal transformation. That's not the ARC conference, right? So that's Alan Hirsch up in their head, right? So Alan's now up in their head. Now, the difficulty is that wave one is created to prepare, screen, train people who will plant churches that will grow to the place they become self-supporting within a typical somewhere 2 to 5 year time frame, that then will give back to the system and plant other similar churches. But now we have diffused the systems. And so people now say, well, I went to Neil Cole's conference, so I want to be an organic church focused on disciple-making movements and will disciple our way into a church plant. All of which I'm for, right? I think I wrote the foreword for all of their books. I'm like the forward machine. Someone had a book on church planning out there, and I walked up, and they said, look, this is the only book that you have that has been written about church planning you have not written the foreword to. And so I just love church planning. I love it all. I want to set a broad table. But here's the problem, okay? So for 30 years, church planters and pastors have been seeing what it looks like to go to get funded like they're in wave one, but they want to function like they're in wave three, and that ultimately is a failed mismatch of missiology to systems. Let me explain. Okay, so if you want to go out and plant an organic network of house churches, I'm for you, but you're not going to get to self-sufficiency within 2 to 5 years, give back to the system so that others can continue that process. So the tracks have to now deal differently with different kinds of church planters. So what I see now is a lot of people who wave one see, well, I saw what happened. I saw the guys who planted those Saddleback clones, and they were fully funded. They got $150,000 from the denomination. Yeah, and 3 years, they were full-time, self-sufficient, giving back to the denominational context, where you're going to do this for 10 years in a mission and incarnational way, and I'm thankful for you, but you can't ask wave one strategies to be funded in a wave three methodology. So in other words, people come to me and say, well, you know, I want to do this a different way. I say, great, praise God, let's help you find a job so you can do it in that way. Why? Because the systems have to line up with the missiological necessity that finances, well, finances are always a driving question inside missiology itself. So wave three has, right, local church-driven stuff, but different tracks. And then partners outside will have to help with those tracks depending upon the level of those tracks, right? So your church, there's going to be somebody comes to your church, and they're just going to be just a bang on, like going to be a great preacher, going to be this. And you're going to say, we're going to partner with the North American Mission where we're going to help place you. But they're going to be a group of 15 to 20 people who love disciple-making, who love Jesus. Somebody, you see some gifts. You're going to be like John Wimber said to Johnny Christ at the Vineyard, said, man, the Spirit's all over you. We're going to work together with you. Let's go plan a thing like that. That's different. That person's probably going to have a different job, have a different track, have a different approach. So, but the thing is, you have to recognize wave one and wave two exist for a reason, and we don't want to unlearn the lessons in wave one and wave two as we engage in wave three where everybody gets to play. Now, I like wave three better, but I think ultimately, missiologically, we have to think, well, really, really wisely, how then do we apply some of these issues? Okay, so it's local church, it's a track system, and finally, letter C, it's multiple doors, or lanes, I like to call them, M-U-L. You'd think I know how to spell multiply. If there was ever a word, you'd know how to spell it this thing. M-U-L-T-I. Multiple lanes. Okay, so I go to Walmart occasionally, as infrequently as possible. Well, when I do, we have Super Walmart where I used to live. I don't know that there's a Walmart near me in Chicago. There must be. It's a big city, but I haven't found it yet. Maybe because I'm intentionally avoiding it. But the Walmart in Hendersonville, Tennessee, is a Super Walmart, and 20 lanes open. All right, and there are 20 lanes options. And one lane open every time I'm there. And like 15 people in that lane. Well, except they have the like self-checkout lane, which is a farce. It never works, and I always end up in the other lane. So I'm in the lane, and I'm in 15 people deep. I took a picture on Twitter or whatever, and because that's what I do. I tweet everything. So I take a picture, and I'm like, oh, whatever. So, but all I got to do is this. I mean, they got 15 people in one lane. You just got to open more lanes. All right, here's the deal when it comes to church planning and church planning systems today. Church planning's hot. It's the big thing. Matter of fact, church planning's way bigger than evangelism. And by the way, sometimes doesn't include evangelism. Just thought I'd mention that. Because that's kind of missing the point. But you notice you can fill up a room with a church planning conference or a justice conference or a reconciliation conference, but you want to talk about telling people about Jesus, it gets strangely silent. In some context. Another story for another day. Well, what happened is that because wave one caught the interest of American Christians, right? So they all sort of know what that looks like. And they want to. So people say to me, I'm the interim pastor at Moody Church in downtown Chicago. So it's a 3,700-seat sanctuary. I'm preaching in the pulpit that Erwin Lutzer and Warren Wiersbe and Ironside and others preached in. And people ask me, you know, why don't you want to pastor that church? I'm just the interim. The interim is the greatest job in the world, right? It's like being a grandparent. They give you too much trouble, you give them back. I'm rocking a tie, whatever. And they say, you know, because whenever you're the interim, it's not like a groundswell. There's always four or five people saying, man, why don't you stay as the pastor? And the last pastor, Erwin Lutzer, was the interim for 18 months. So, like, everyone's like, yeah, we know Erwin Lutzer. So you're going to, no, I'm not. I have no interest in being your pastor. And there's a lot of reasons why I have no interest in being your pastor. And I love them, but I wear a tie. That's one reason I have no interest in being your pastor. I had to go find one. But part of the reason is that I and a whole generation of people who grew up seeing Wave 1 want to go out. I planted six churches. They want to go out and start something from scratch. And they actually know that probably their church 20 years from now will be substantially larger if they planted it than if they revitalized it. Okay, so there's that Wave 1 influence that kind of comes across the whole thing, right? So it sort of gets to the place. So what happens is the line that Wave 1 built in Walmart has 15 people in it, and we don't have enough money for that. Now, and here's the thing, you can't buy your way into a church multiplication movement. We'll never have enough money for that. Now, most denominations are kind of out of money. Now, let me affirm what North American Mission Board did, is they redirected their funds, and so they are uniquely able and made hard decisions that I didn't think they could make. I told the president of the North American Mission Board he was on a fool's errand and it wouldn't work. And so I just spoke at his trustee meeting this week and said, I was wrong, which I try not to say a lot, but I am a lot. But what happens is that you've got all these people who saw the Wave 1ers who are thankful for the Wave 2ers, but ultimately need to open up new lanes. And so we've got to redirect. Some of the people are sort of waiting in line for the cash to actually say there are other ways to get in the mission. And it fits more the Wave 3 diffusion of systems into local churches. So how then do we do that? Well, ultimately, I want to send people who say to me, you know, Ed, I got a seminary degree. I want you to go to Blueprint, and I want you to live in that community. And out of that disciple-making community, I want you to multiply out of that and plant churches out of that while you're working at Home Depot or while you're working at Starbucks or wherever else it may be. And so that changes it. And by the way, can I just say that the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which President Obama calls Obamacare, so I'll call Obamacare, though Bill Clinton said yesterday it was crazy, which you got to love having Bill Clinton on your side, but that's another story with friends like that. The Affordable Care Act is one of the most defining acts legally for church planting in North America today because it changes the question about insurance, which has been a defining question for church planters since I've been planting churches. That's not a political statement, whatever, but what I'm saying to you is that if redefined, so for bivocational, if you can get a full-time job, you will have health insurance, and that changes the scenario for church planting that I've been doing for 30 years for families. Not yet. So the picture then becomes, how do we move forward, building on Wave 1, but still acknowledging the need for Wave 1? How do we then move forward with the expansion that we're thankful for? But now, it's not just expansion where the organizations run it, it's the local churches taking hold of this. In conclusion, in one of our chapters in Viral Churches, we talk about this. We talk about the local church becoming the church planting agency. Now, again, the 30 minutes I have, actually, technically, it was only 22. I want to thank you for that, Dahati. But in the time I have, I can't unpack all of that. But I want to encourage you to take a look there. And also, we do some more stuff. You know, NAM's doing stuff. We're doing stuff at newchurches.com. And I'll go from there. It's actually time to be done, but I'm okay. I don't have anywhere to be. I'll answer any questions until you tell me I should be done. And then I will listen to the amazing Tim Weed. And also, you might have questions for Dahati, who's way more articulate than I am anyway. You want to ask your question now? Go ahead. Yeah, there's no question. I mean, there are schools that are pressing in that way. Eastern Seminary, which is renamed, is it Parham now, the one in Philadelphia? I forget the name of it. And they do an MBA, but it tends to be kind of driven more around, you know, third world economic development. And so I think ultimately we have to find ways. But the answer to your question is how are educational institutions doing this? Not well. Because they're in a track. They're in a lane. Now, it doesn't mean the educational institutions aren't doing well. Danny Aiken, who's a president of a seminary, once said to me, he's very helpful. He said, don't ask seminaries to do everything. We can do some stuff. He says, we don't do leadership training well because the people we attract are actually people who are scholars. So we can do biblical studies and preaching and all that sort of stuff. So what I would say is I think partly it gets back to what you're saying here. When this and this were the thing, made sense here. Here, if it's a local church thing, I think local churches need to take responsibility. So for me, when I planted my first church, so I can plumb a house, I can wire a house from scratch, I can run a panel, I can do. I was a contractor. And so when I planted my church in the inner city of Buffalo, New York, the home mission board at the time turned me down to be a church planter. I later became the person in charge of turning down. I still have the letter. So what I did is I got a job, but I had skills as a contractor, and I could run. I built houses. But what if you don't? Here's the thing. That's not that hard of a skill. And so what I would say is to find some skills. Now, Steve Shogren, who's here at this conference, wrote a book, Creating Communities for the Kingdom. And in there he has a chapter of suggested vocations that pastors can step into who are church planner types that probably would fit well into. And so, but I agree, there's not a lot. There's not a dual track system. You're going to probably have to do it yourself, and churches are going to take that on. Other question for Dahadi or I. Yes, in the back. Can I just say congratulations on the goatee, man? That is sweet. I'm feeling the love. I'm feeling the love.
Here's the question. There's two tracks that are running. Not what we're talking about. Then what comes to church plant?
Not a trend. Outliers, sure. Matt Chandler, Tim Keller, they got a plan. So I'm more for church planning than I am for multi-site, but that doesn't mean I'm not for multi-site. You know, so Sunday, if the hurricane doesn't destroy Miami, I'm not supposed to preach at Christ Fellowship, my church. I'm a teaching pastor. We run about 10,000 on a weekend. We have 9 sites, video venues. So I'm for that. But we also love church planning. And so, but I think that the reason a lot of church planners are kind of pushing back on the multi-site thing is, just to be perfectly honest, in a lot of churches that were passionate about church planning 20 years ago, they're now passionate about multi-site. And I think one of the reasons they're passionate about multi-site, not the only reason and not the reason for everybody, but one of the reasons is it kind of keeps it in your church. And, you know, and I think there are some missiological implications of projecting the graven image of celebrity rock star pastors on movie screens across the United States. I'd rather see churches planted. I'm thankful. I told Andy Stanley this. I wrote an article about this. I said, I'm thankful that Andy Stanley can create new sites. I just want more Andy Stanleys. I want articulate communicators of the Bible who can teach. And that requires a multiplication mindset, not just an addition through sites. But I'm for it. Last church I planted, I left 2 months ago, multi-site, you know, so I'm for it. I just think church planting needs to be our priority.
So
to both and leaning more towards church planting.
So what are the numbers?
How many more questions do you have, sir?
And what are the numbers, the impact of the two?
I don't know.
You just mentioned some numbers.
I don't know. Multi-site's harder to track. I mean, it's the new normal for large churches. Church planting now, we're actually planting more churches than we closed, as Dave quoted. He misquoted the number, but he nevertheless was correct in the general theme. We planted 300 more churches than we closed last year in the United States. Dave, you just get him up, let him make up stats. You know, 87% of stats mentioned at this conference are made up at this conference. And that's okay. I love everybody. All right, I think we need to be fair to others around. It is time for us to break. Can you join me in thanking Dahadi and Tim for hosting us?
So much. Invite you back to the next one of the workshops here after.